Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots, The Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Cindy Yu and I'm joined by James Forsyth and Katie Bors. So late last night, China has finally passed its national security law and the contents are now obvious. Anyone who criticises China or advocates for secession of Hong Kong from China will be facing imprisonment of up to life in China. James, this is quite a radical law, as we all knew it was going to be, but now the details are out. China this morning has already been arresting protesters for breaching this law, and the annual protest on the 1st of July is now being cancelled. What is Britain going to do?
Dominic Raab made a statement to the House of Commons earlier saying that the UK does consider this to be a breach of one country, two systems, which is in a joint treaty signed by both the UK and China and lodged at the United Nations. And Dominic Raab said that because it is a breach, the UK will proceed with offering a path to British citizenship for Hong Kong BNOs, British National Overseas Passport holders, and crucially, better pensions. That means that people who've been born since 1997 to people who are eligible for a BNO passport will be able to come too. Now, this is a welcome first step from the government. This country has a moral obligation to these people. We signed up to one country, two systems. It is quite clear now. It is one country, one authoritarian system. I don't think the government is going quite far enough, though. I think we need to be offering people practical assistance to move to this country. It's not just that this country has a moral debt to these people who consider themselves British, many of whom were very surprised to find that they couldn't move here in ahead of 1997 in the handover. But we also, it is in our own economic self-interest to do this. Hong Kong has a higher GDP per capita than the UK. These people are from one of the most productive and most educated cities in the world. And you know, so this is not only the morally right thing to do, it is the right thing from our national self-interest. But I also think we need to learn a lesson from this in the West, which is this is another sign that the more powerful China becomes, the less worried it will be about breaking its international treaty commitments. And I think we also see something here, which is there was a view in the British government, which has turned out to be wrong, that the Chinese authorities would boil the frog slowly. The law would pass, it wouldn't be used straight away. Already there are reports that people have been arrested using this new law. And I mean, this absolutely shows that there is a need for urgent action by the democratic states of the world, whether in the West or in the Asia-Pacific region, to counter China. China is the greatest single threat there is right now to the rules-based international order. And its willingness to break its international commitments in the Anglo-Sino Declaration on Hong Kong in such a blatant way is a reminder that the West needs to wise up to this and fast.
And it's also not about what the government has done this morning. It's also about what it discourages people from doing in the coming months, because already we're hearing protesters are resigning their posts in these pro-democracy organisations for fear of repercussions. Katie, James says that the government should be going further. Within the Conservative Party, is there much appetite for going harder on China, or is there ongoing debate there?
I think when it comes to China, there is... The Conservative Party has become increasingly hawkish on China. I think that there is a general sense that a tough line on China is the right way to go. I think that if you are one of those voices, and I think there are a couple arguing, wait a minute, think about free trade. We're a country that says we want to do free trade. We might get something with the EU. Not looking great in the short term of America. Maybe we need to tread carefully here, if you think about China and the size of its economy. You're a voice in the minority. I think generally speaking, the party has moved, number 10 have moved too, if you think about how they're changing their position on Huawei. But I would say that where number 10 is and where the parliamentary party is, I still think number 10 would have to move a bit to the hawkish side to be in keeping with the whole of the parliamentary party in terms of mood. So I think this is something that is going to be widely supported. And I think in terms of the line that you should take with China, quite a hard line is something that will be well received within the party. And what's also interesting, though, is this is something which is also coming from Labour to a degree. So you hear from Lisa Nandy, the Shadow Foreign Secretary, and she came out quite early on this morning before we had these announcements suggesting that the UK need to stand up for its duty to Hong Kong. And that comes at the same time where, you know, Labour is also being a voice of scepticism on China. And I think when you have both main parties, different levels, but voicing concerns, that starts to get a point where it's hard, you know, there is clearly one direction of travel here.
And there's a fascinating poll out today from Populous, from the China Research Group, which shows that not only do the vast majority of the British public favour offering BNOs a route to British citizenship, but people are prepared to pay more if that builds national self-resilience from China in areas like telecoms and medical supplies and equipment. I think public opinion on China has moved. I think a few years ago there was no public appetite for a tougher line on China. People saw China as leading to cheaper consumer goods, and that was a positive. Now I think the public attitude has changed quite dramatically. I think people have become aware of the danger that China poses to the current international order.
And James, what about the timing of all this? Today we hear that America has booked up quite a lot of the reserves of remdesivir, one of the vaccine candidates from Gilead, and the British government has had to say, you know, we have enough as well. But China has also got five candidates in the vaccine race. Do we risk basically getting out of this pandemic earlier if we take a hard line with China now?
But it's undoubtedly an element of vaccine diplomacy, and one of the reasons why the UK has the UK at the beginning of this crisis had no domestic vaccine manufacturing capability at all. That is quite clearly a national resilience issue, because the US, under the Defence Production Act, has the ability to essentially corral all suppliers of a vaccine if discovered by a US company wherever they're manufactured in the world into the US market before we're allowed to go anywhere else. China is obviously going to indulge in vaccine diplomacy if it finds one, you know, handing it out to countries it favours. The UK obviously needs its own domestic vaccine manufacturing capability. Now, we learnt today that the Oxford vaccine, which has decent prospects of success, AstraZeneca, who are going to do the commercial manufacture of it, think that it's 50-50. They have injected people in South Africa and Brazil because the virus is spreading more freely there than it is here. And so the hope that that will give you a better idea of what resistance it gives. But quite clearly, if China does discover the vaccine, China will use that power to try and intimidate countries in the way that it is currently trying to intimidate Australia by saying that, you know, it won't accept imports from various Australian abattoirs because of Australia's criticism of China's handling of the initial coronavirus outbreak in Wuhan. So there is absolutely no doubt that China will try and use whatever position and power it has to pull other countries into line. And I mean, that is why the democratic world needs to cooperate.
And Katie, meanwhile, the local lockdown in Leicester has started. But amidst some confusion, today Keir Starmer challenged Boris Johnson at PMQs over the data around surrounding the local lockdown and why it was so slow in getting to the region. What did Boris have to say in return?
Well, he suggested there wasn't such a problem as the Labour leader was alleging, and said that actually, although Keir Starmer's pointing to a series of lost time to a degree where there was clear there was an issue in Leicester, but nothing had been done immediately. He pointed out that the government had brought in extra testing and basically tried to suggest they had not been complacent. I think there are a few things here. So first off, there is some questioning of the wisdom of calling this a whack-a-mole strategy when it comes to local lockdowns. I think that if you think back to the days of the sombrero and squashing the sombrero, Boris Johnson is clearly a politician who can use language in a way that gets a lot of attention, sometimes good, sometimes quite bad, in terms of that attention. But I think when you're looking at a public health crisis, some of these more jovial terms can suggest you're not taking it fully seriously. But there's another issue, which is if you remove, you know, whack-a-mole and the fact that it really suggests you're dealing with a problem permanently, the idea of lots of local lockdowns, it's ultimately something that the Prime Minister and his team has suggested we are going to have to live with as a price of not being in a national lockdown. And I don't think it is quite clear that everyone has come to terms with this yet. And it's, at the moment, you have the opposition obviously going on an attack over this. Now, some in government obviously would rather not have a local lockdown in Leicester, but they don't see it as damning to their whole strategy that this is happening. The test is more if they can't control it and it stops being a local lockdown, a wider issue and potentially a wider lockdown, I think that would be detrimental and it clearly suggests the strategy doesn't work. But the general idea of just having a local lockdown, I don't think is seen as a sign things aren't working, but it's so easy for others to attack and is seeing it as a sign as failure already. I think it points to how bumpy the future's going to be, because at the moment I'm not sure if the message has landed that the government strategy involves living with coronavirus for some time. I think a lot of people think that if we just hang on, we might be like New Zealand, have it go completely. I think what is perhaps adding to that sense of confusion is it does seem in Scotland, if you look at one of the medical advisors in Scotland talking about, wrote a piece for The Guardian suggesting that if we just keep doing what we're doing for another 2 months, we could get close to New Zealand. Now, I think there are questions as to whether, you know, New Zealand being a much more remote island and much more sparse population, if that would be possible. But at the moment, I just don't think there is a sense yet of where the government is heading this, which is widely recognised.
I think Katie is completely right. I mean, first of all, I think as an international travel hub, it would be quite hard to get to the New Zealand position. But first of all, the government's aim is to replace the sledgehammer of a national lockdown with more targeted interventions. But I would add one caveat to what Katie said. This is the easy local lockdown in that the furlough scheme is still going, all the government support to businesses are still going. It becomes much more difficult. Let's imagine that July the 4th happens, we don't end up having to go back into a national lockdown. And let's imagine in October, when all these schemes have been wound up, suddenly Bristol, for example, has to be locked down. What support are you going to offer to people in Bristol and to businesses in Bristol that suddenly can't go to work and have been ordered by the government to shut? And I think that is the challenge. I mean, in some ways, this is the easy moment to do a local lockdown, because however chafing it will be for people in Bristol to see people, you know, just outside the city boundary, being able to go for a pint on Saturday, they're still getting support in terms of their paycheck and in terms of the viability of their businesses. It's much, much harder once we've got beyond the point at which these schemes have been wound up because the country's coming back to normal, if suddenly it's your town or your city which gets hit with one of these local lockdowns.
And Katie, you report in your political column in the upcoming issue of The Spectator, out tomorrow, that Keir Starmer is looking to change his approach in attacking the government. What is he going to do?
Well, I think it's a refocusing. So far, in terms of how Keir Starmer has opposed the government, I think he inherited a situation that was in some ways helpful to the opposition, because it's clearly overwhelming for a government to suddenly be facing a global pandemic. But at least in the early stages, there was this rally around a flag feeling. And I think it was hard to criticise the Prime Minister when lots of, you know, a large chunk of the public wanted it, everyone to kind of have this national effort. So he had to tread quite carefully. We saw him try to frame it as, you know, lockdown should be, what's your lockdown plan for easing it? At a time when not everyone was really thinking about it, but since then has tried to question, you know, test and trace. And I think that the new focus, and we have got a hint of that today actually in Prime Minister's questions, it's all going to be about jobs. So the furlough scheme is slowly being, you know, wound up, not for several months, but we're going to begin to see that, you know, more contributions employers are going to have to pay. And I think where Keir Starmer is going to attack or, you know, oppose the government is on what they expect to be very high unemployment. And if you look at what Boris Johnson is talking about, investment, there is still in all Boris Johnson's speeches an acknowledgement that jobs will be lost. The Chancellor has also said they cannot save every job. Now, I'm not suggesting that were they to come up with a different formula, they would be able to. It's clearly impossible to save every job. But I think for Labour, when you're facing a Conservative government, which, yes, their New Deal wasn't quite the New Deal they had led us to believe in terms of spending proportion, but comparatively for a Tory government, this is a high-spend government. So I think from Labour's perspective, given that Labour often seem to have a weakness on the economy anyway in terms of high spend, do you want to go after the government for not spending enough when they're already spending a large amount for a Tory government? Or actually the easier thing, and the thing I think most people are going to probably feel affects them more, particularly by mid, you know, late summer, is the fact that lots of people are being made redundant. And what's the government's plan for that? So I think that's the line we're going to keep hearing.
There is also, it's clever politics, because it is inevitable that unemployment is going to spike. And so Labour are getting ahead of the game on that. Also, there are good reasons not to want to. I mean, Keir Starmer's and Labour's demand is to extend the furlough in these particularly heavy hit industries. There are actually good reasons not to want to do that, because some of these industries, to be brutal, are not coming back, certainly not in the way that they were before the pandemic. And if you were to continue the furlough in those areas, people wouldn't people wouldn't get laid off, which would be a good thing. But the bad thing is that people wouldn't move to the growing, more productive parts of the economy. It might be that people leave working for an airline and go and work for a tech company, or, you know, whatever example you want to pick. But, you know, there are clearly some bits of the economy that are going to grow in the post-COVID yes. world, and some bits are going to contract. If the government keeps on intervening to prop up those companies, those bits of the economy that are going to contract, you prevent that natural reallocation of human capital.
James, record low unemployment has been one of the proudest achievements of recent Conservative governments. Do you think this jobs attack will be quite effective for Conservative voters?
I think there's an interesting question here, which is the recovery in the 2010s was very weak on productivity, but very strong on jobs. And that politically was actually easier for the Tory government to deal with, because they could boast of record high employment, record low unemployment. I think the signs that we've seen so far are that this recovery is going to be strong on productivity, because the lockdown and social distancing have made all companies look at how they can do more with fewer staff. And so that's going to make it stronger on productivity. I think it'll be relatively weak on jobs, because the two areas of the economy that particularly took up the slack in terms of employment in the recovery of the last decade were retail and hospitality. And those are the two bits which are going to be most hard hit by coronavirus, because social distancing, people's reluctance to go out, people's reluctance to mingle with other people, hit those two sectors particularly hard.
James and Katie, thanks very much. And to hear more from Katie about Keir Starmer's first 100 days and what he has planned for the future, join us on the Edition podcast out tomorrow, where I'll be speaking with Katie and Paul Mason. Thanks for listening, and join us again tomorrow.
Get 12 weeks of The Spectator in print and online for just £12. And we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.